welcome to our second podcast focusing on malnutrition. My name's Graham Stretch. I'm the president of the PCPA. In our first podcast, we looked at the role pharmacists can play in identifying and managing malnutrition in patients. In this follow-up podcast, we're going to look at case studies, two case studies, in fact. And once again, I welcome Sam Cudby, who's a practice pharmacist from Addlesden, Surrey, and Anne Holdaway, a consultant dietitian, chair of the malnutrition pathway. We're going to discuss nutritional interventions that we might think about using in these patients. The first patient is a frail care home patient. She's 91. She's got a number of comorbidities. She's got cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, gout, and she's also experiencing vascular dementia. She has a proper case of polypharmacy, 12 different medicines she takes each day. Sam, did you want to talk in more detail about this patient?
So this is a patient in one of our nursing homes. She's recently been in hospital with COVID-19. She was treated, she recovered, she didn't need ventilation, but she was discharged back to the nursing home much poorer than when she went in. My main problem with this patient when she came out was that she was still on all her medication that she went in on, and she was started on collagen extra emulsion 30 mils twice a day between meals and 40 sip liquid 200 mils twice a day. She came out not eating and drinking particularly well. She came out very confused and not taking her medication very well. She had a review by speech and language therapists who identified no particular swallowing issues. She didn't have a review by a dietitian in the hospital. So she was back in the nursing home. She was very unsettled. Spoke to the nurses by phone about her, and we actually did do quite a comprehensive review of her medication, and we stopped quite a few of them, mainly because she wasn't taking them anyway herself. But we didn't really know what we were meant to do with these collagen extra emulsion. That's not something we often start in primary care. And obviously she was being given 200 mils of a supplement, which she was struggling to take, and then didn't have any room for anything else. So, Anne, what do you think we should do here?
Yeah, so do you have any idea, Sam, of how she was managed in hospital nutritionally during the infection? Did they send any information out with her?
No, but I don't think she ate particularly well or drank particularly well, because her respect form came out saying not for hospital readmission if poor oral intake is the cause.
Right, and I assume then she was put on a sort of standard oral nutritional supplement to try and tide her over. That's fairly routine at hospital level with somebody with a poor appetite. I know during the COVID-19 pandemic, with patients going into hospital, services have struggled a little. You know, staff have been very much moved around, not familiar with ward environments. We know they haven't necessarily had assistance at mealtimes. So we know many of the patients who went into hospital with a COVID-19 infection and were unwell enough to need a hospital admission and possibly need oxygen therapy, we know their intakes were very poor in hospitals. So in a 91-year-old, she's probably running quite a nutritional deficit now, and you know, it'd be nice to think we could make up for a little bit of that now she's being managed back in the care home. And I was just going to ask you, Sam, is the care home quite good? Do they fortify the meals? Do they provide assistance at mealtimes?
This is one of the really positive things about this nursing home, is that they are very good at food first and food fortification. Their meal portion sizes are really good. They're not too huge, so they're not overwhelming for the residents, and they get a sense of satisfaction that they've actually finished finished a meal. So I am fairly confident that once she's back home and once she's settled back into the nursing home, they will be able to encourage her to eat again.
Yeah, and I think looking at her history, you know, with the case of vascular dementia, I'd like to think the care home is thinking about finger foods and that independence at mealtimes, which we know patients often respond very positively to. If they're fortifying the diet and giving the assistance at mealtimes, and as you say, not overfacing their residents, you know, it's so often they'll think, oh, the patient's not eating very well, I'll just pile some food up on the plate to get them to eat more. And in fact, it has the opposite effect. So it sounds like the care home's in a good position with their catering to support this lady. I'd say, actually, looking at the supplements she was given, I mean, collagen extra, not something we'd recommend being used without a dietitian's input, because it's not balanced nutrition, it's fat calories. And probably in this lady, you know, she's probably in need of some protein to help her recover and regain some strength. She's on a supplement that's 200 mils, and probably the first thing I would look at for this lady is looking at a more compact version. So the same number of calories, the same amount of nutrition, but in 125 mils rather than 200 mils. So swapping over to just a product that's more compact would probably be my first advice for this lady, to try and help her manage the supplements that are going to provide a significant top up to her intake without sort of overwhelming her with a large volume. So that's probably an easy win there for her. And then ensuring the care home is providing her with easy chew foods, the finger foods. I would probably discontinue the collagen extra and just focus on them trying to get a compact or nutritional supplement in. And actually, one of the things we know from collagen extra and why it's quite popular is because it's often given like a 30 ml shot. But I would say what they could do is actually think about the oral nutritional supplement. I think in this case, it was a 46 product. You could look at the compact version and actually administer it as 30 ml shots. If she's comfortable with that, is actually encourage it in small amounts. And what we know from the use of supplements is it doesn't often impact on the next meal. I think the fear sometimes is if you give them a supplement in between, it'll then make them eat less at a meal time. And we don't actually see that in practice. What we tend to see is it's additive, as long as it's not given too close to a meal time. But as I say, in small amounts between meals, it will give quite a significant top up for her nutrition and help with her recovery. The other thing that you might want to consider in the long term, I think in her history of medications, was the use of laxatives and senna. And you could also consider in the future about if her bowels are still a problem, rather than having to take, you know, two more medications, is rationalise that. And if she's getting constipated, think about an oral nutritional supplement in a compact form. If she's happy with that, include one with fibre. They don't taste any difference. It's not like they've got bits of fibre floating in it that the lady would notice that she's having that fibre. So as long as it's not contraindicated for any reason, that might be an option going forward as well.
Okay, thank you. It's an interesting case, and I think all too common. We care for 1,000 nursing home beds, and actually what I find really interesting is that you would bring out is very often the first symptom of C19 has been a lack of appetite. And it just makes me wonder whether dietetics have had a role actually in the diagnosis. So we think it might well be down to the anosmia that we know is common, and actually they just simply lose the enjoyment of the food and their appetite, and that leads on then to becoming malnourished, which I think is probably part of the syndrome that is the coronavirus, the C19, and they become disoriented and delirious, and then often get treated wrongly. You mentioned this patient had not for hospital on their notes when they came out. Is that because the hospital didn't feel there were reversible conditions here, or was that the wishes of her family? I'm not sure. What were their thoughts?
No, when she was in hospital, she wasn't eating very well at all, and they tried to put an NG tube in, which she didn't tolerate. They then considered a PEG tube, which she didn't tolerate. So they discharged her with, you know, not for hospital readmission if she is not eating or drinking, because we've tried everything and we're not going to rectify this. daughter wasn't involved, actually. The daughter was very upset when I spoke to her on the phone. And actually, the respect form has been rewritten to match their current wishes.
And I think that's not unusual, Sam. What you're highlighting there is, you know, patients, you know, when they're not eating very much and they're unwell, you know, they often give up. And then their families are very concerned about them, and they pick up on that anxiety, and it becomes this downward spiral. And we definitely know that when malnutrition is present, it can cause changes in mood and behavior and this withdrawal. And I certainly have plenty of cases in my role in palliative care where they come out of hospital for end of life care, and they're very much turned around by the team with a bit of a TLC, rationalization of the medications, support at meal times, and then appropriate nutritional supplementation if it's needed, can really start to begin to reverse the situation they're in. And, you know, we do tend to bring some patients back to life on that basis. And, you know, they get a new zest for life and become much more engaged. And that's often very evident to the care home staff as well. They see them re-engaging with activities and conversations within the home and re-engaging with their family as well. So I think nutrition sometimes goes very much beyond the realms of that weight on the scales and to more how we're feeling.
Absolutely. And familiar environments, familiar faces, the carers just having that perhaps that little bit more time to help and assist at meal times in the way that probably didn't happen in the hospital. Of course, the families can't visit patients with C19 in the hospital. And that, you know, very often it is the family member that assists at meal time, certainly with hydration and so on as well. So I think actually just taking particularly dementia patients out of familiar surroundings in and of itself can cause nutritional deficit, and I think that that's just not recognized enough. And the sooner we can get patients back into familiar surroundings, very often they will consider and start to eat again. Sam, you mentioned there was some medication stopped when she was returned to the home.
We did think that, you know, she was on far too many medicines for what she was capable of dealing with at this point. And I did have a long conversation with her daughter just to make her understand that we weren't stopping medications for any other reason than that, you know, we felt it was good for the patient, it was a good opportunity. And so we stopped a lot of her cardiovascular medication. And we stopped her medication for gout, mainly because she hadn't taken it regularly. So we didn't feel that she was getting any benefit from it. In fact, she ended up just on two tablets and something for constipation.
Excellent. And that was going to make all the difference as well, I think, to her. You know, it actually very often on these medicines called nausea, and we just don't know, particularly with dementia patients, and that also could really help, I think. Excellent. Okay, so on to our second case then. This is a community patient this time, a 72-year-old who's living with Parkinson's disease. What have you got to tell us about this patient?
So this patient lives with his wife in the community, and they are a very proud, independent couple. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease just 2 years ago, and prior to that, he was really fit and healthy. He is on medication for his mood. He's on three different medicines for his pain. He's on medication for constipation, and he's on Madopar for his Parkinson's. In the last 6 months, he's lost a significant amount of weight. In 2018, he weighed just over 84 kilos. He now weighs 54 kilos, and it has taken me quite a long time to persuade him to accept dietetic advice. Interesting enough, all my consultations with this patient, right from the very beginning, have been over the telephone. I've not actually met him face to face. It's all been on the telephone because he doesn't get out very much because he's very poor mobility, and he doesn't like really to meet new people. He has quite poor swallow, so we did spend quite a lot of time changing his medicines from solid oral to liquids and dispersibles. So particularly the Madopar, we changed to dispersible tablets. But actually, we found that with the liquids, they just dribbled out of his mouth. So we've actually gone back to the solid oral form, which he takes now with quite thick yogurt, and he manages that really well. He really hates the fact that some of the liquids were sweet and he felt were for babies, and he hates the fact that he has to be fed now. Again, you know, I am a baby now and I have to be fed. But he has significant weight loss, so we really needed dietetic advice about what to do with him. So I don't know how you feel, what you would have said, Anne.
Yeah, so looking at this gentleman, and obviously very supportive wife by the sounds of things, and wanting to get things right. So looking at his history, I mean, quite a profound weight loss there, which puts him at high risk of malnutrition with that weight loss over that time, a very low body mass index coming in at 18.4 kilograms per meter squared. So he's very underweight. He's probably sarcopenic with that rate of weight loss over time at his age with Parkinson's disease. I would say he's probably now looking very frail and with significant muscle loss. So that's classed as sarcopenia. And perhaps his intake is limited now at mealtimes because of his swallowing problems. And it'd be interesting to know, you know, how acceptable any dietary advice was to his wife. And what you sometimes come across when somebody's been heavier in the past and they've been following a lifelong sort of healthy eating plan and trying to get it right, that actually they might be a little resistant to dietary advice. And I think with this gentleman and his wife, it might be looking at some of the foods that they're having and the meals that they're having, and explaining that sometimes relaxing these healthy eating guidelines, which are designed for the general population to avoid us gaining weight, they do need relaxing at times when our appetite's poor and our intake is limited, so that you can start getting more calories from the foods that we're eating. So sort of making every mouthful count. So I would certainly look at that about the acceptability of dietary advice and explaining that some of the dietary adjustments to increase what we call the nutrient density of diets is important to try and preserve function and keeping him as strong as possible and trying to preserve those muscles really for his function. This gentleman was on, I think he was on the 40 sip compact one twice a day. And if he's struggling with some of the textures, you often find that the protein foods can be really challenging. And for somebody like this, I might be thinking, oh, would something like a 40 sip compact protein supplement be better? And just to compare the two products, in a 40 sip compact product, you'd have like 12 grams of protein, and 40 sip compact protein, there'd be 18 grams of protein. Now, that doesn't sound very much difference between the two products, but when you equate to what that is in terms of foods, 18 grams of protein in that little 125ml bottle taken twice a day is equivalent to eating a chicken breast. And if this gentleman's got swallowing problems, chewing problems, his intake at mealtimes might be quite poor because his appetite's limited and he might tire and fatigue during mealtimes, that 40 sip compact protein might boost his protein intake and prevent further loss of muscle, which is going to, you know, if he's losing muscle, he's going to be at risk of falls and he'll be immunocompromised as well. And the other thing is when he's taking his medication and has his preference to take it in yogurts is, you know, would he enjoy some variety in the supplements and go to a dessert style supplement? So you might want to exchange one of his supplements for a dessert style supplement, something like 40 creme, for example, would be a suitable supplement to replace like one of his liquid supplements with. And he might just enjoy that change in variety, because some patients are on these products for quite some time. And in this case, you know, he's very underweight, and there's very clear ACBS indication there as to why you would want somebody like this on an oral nutritional supplement, because we're trying to prevent those falls and hospital admissions and fractured neck of femur, which would obviously inevitably cost an awful lot. So yes, I would probably look at those options for this gentleman. and give support to his wife as well.
His wife really liked the food fortification leaflets because she felt that was something that she could do. Really, you know, her way of contributing.
And I think, you know, that's very much been at the heart of what we were doing with the malnutrition pathway, with the panel and the resources and developing the resources that are very centred on, you know, what patients and carers can do for themselves. So there's that whole sense of empowerment about something that she can do if she enjoys cooking and she wants to support her husband and she knows that his food intake is quite poor. That can be quite demoralising in itself at times when you're producing a meal and then they're either turning it down or not eating much. So, you know, by making every mouthful count, she can be assured that fortifying the food, particularly adding things like milk powder into some of the dishes that she might be cooking, some of the savoury dishes, will also be increasing the protein and vitamin and calorie content of that, and then topping it up with a supplement in between as well. So yeah, I think it is about recognising the importance of her role as the provider of care, and also, you know, the love and care that she puts into food, which is often a vehicle for showing that we care for somebody as well.
The big problem we've had with them is that obviously as pharmacists, we prescribe oral nutritional supplements as an acute on the prescription. So when the patient comes to order it, they can't see that one. It doesn't come up on their order screen. So he thinks he's not allowed it anymore. And it's each month I have to push it out to them. So for them, that monthly review is really critical to make sure that they're still getting that supplement that they so desperately need.
And I think that's always an opportunity, isn't it, to reinforce it or see if something is changing or do they need weaning off it, you know, or some modification.
Excellent. I'm fascinated. Really interesting the way that you managed to put into context what the gram quantities of protein are. And listening to you talk about that 18 grams of protein in the 40 sip. And equating that to chicken breast, I think that's a really useful insight in a way that I can translate it into something meaningful for our patients and indeed for me, so that I can put into context what it is that I'm talking about in this drink, what it equates to. This is the same as you eating a chicken breast. And I just think it could really help me to counsel patients in terms of their concordance, to be able to put that context to them so they understand the value of having one of these supplements. So where might I look for that information, Anne?
So within the malnutrition pathway resources, so that's on the website, www.malnutritionpathway.co.uk. There are a range of resources. There's a leaflet specifically on protein, but that leaflet is also linked in to some of the other resources, including the resources for managing some of the dietary issues during COVID-19 seen in our patients, like loss of appetite and breathlessness and dry mouth. But it's also in the core malnutrition pathway, which has the resources according to malnutrition risk. So I'd encourage pharmacists, if they're interested and there's no local resources to hand, to look at the Malnutrition Pathway website, and you'll see those resources can be downloaded or emailed to your patients or added to your desktops.
Fantastic, thank you. Sam, this gentleman, it sounds like his primary carer and indeed his only carer is wife. I mean, what's his wife's health like? Very often I see patients where both of them are very frail and you just wonder how they manage. How is his wife? Is she a patient of yours?
His wife is also our patient, and she's actually fine. Until 2 years ago, they were both really fit and healthy. So she is actually, I think she is quite exhausted with caring for him. And it has become her sole focus. And so keeping him well and healthy and getting him to as good a place as we can is quite important for, you know, for both of them, really.
Yeah, these are the kinds of patients that in a PCN world now are the very patients that I'm encouraging to see our social prescriber. Because actually that 1 hour out for the wife down at the local kind of, you know, coffee morning or whatever it might be can make all the difference to her mental health, actually, because this is a tough old job. And whether or not that is the case, they need someone to come and pick them up. We've got voluntary organisations that will do that. And I just think we miss a trick, actually. We, again, don't think in a very holistic way about these kinds of patients, not as an individual, but in their functional social context. And I think that we are learning, as pharmacists, we need to learn that patients do not live in isolation. When they, the conversation you have with them over the phone in this case, but you know, we need to put their needs into the context of their lives. And if we don't do that, then actually we're tinkering around the edges, because they don't live in the surgery, they live in their homes. And actually, what support is available? And I just encourage every trainee to find out what support's available, where those places are, so that actually in a much more rounded sense, we can help patients with their well-being. I wonder, you know, as you say, his swallow failed, and it was very interesting that you said you'd gone to liquids. And I think we all just do that, second nature. But actually, sometimes the watery liquids are the worst things we can do. Did the gentleman have any aspirational problems with those? Was it a fear thing?
No, he was assessed by speech and language, and they recommended everything be changed to liquids to ensure a safe swallow. But it just didn't work for him at all. They actually said he was fine with thin liquids, just not to use a straw, which is what he was doing. He was using a straw, but they said no, to just use thin liquids. But it was more the movement around his mouth that he wasn't managing.
Is there a dignity thing maybe about him feeling, that thing you said about him feeling rather like an infant?
Infant, yes. He just wants his independence back. And he really struggles with not being able to do things for himself.
Yeah. Anne, do you find yourself working with speech and language a great deal?
Yeah, indeed we do. And in some of the work that I do with cancer patients and in palliative care, so we're dealing with patients with head and neck cancer with swallow problems. Esophageal cancer is slightly different. They often don't have speech and language therapy input, but they have to go on modified texture diets. And I do remember one of the cases in my research where he commented he'd been advised on a pureed diet, and he said, "That's for babies. I'm not a baby." And it very much links into that whole dignity. And he would rather sit and chew some food. He had head and neck cancer, but sit and chew it for quite some time just to have that whole satisfaction of solid food and the pleasure associated with that than eating what he classed as slop. Mm. And there are lots of ways around that, you know, there are now molds you can get for doing pureed foods, so you get the visual appeal of the food looking more realistic. But some patients just don't like that sort of smooth pureed texture in the mouth. But there are transitional foods as well, and some patients are actually quite safe with transitional foods. So where they have something like a cracker, not a cream cracker that goes really flaky, but a biscuit where it's crumbly and with a bit of moisture in the mouth, it will go to a smooth paste. So they're the transitional foods, and it can give some patients, if it's safe to swallow, that whole sensation of having something solid that then goes to a paste and they can safely swallow it. And I think that's where speech and language therapists and dietitians working together come into their own to really work with a family, so this gentleman and his wife, to say, you know, what are the foods you miss? Because I have patients and I always say to them, what foods do you really miss? And then I try to be creative to think about, okay, that's how you really miss it in that form. How can we cook it or prepare it so you still get either the taste or the texture that you can tolerate, that's suitable to your needs? So I think that's where the dietitian, speech and language system can work together. And I think sometimes in those cases with this gentleman, he's got Parkinson's disease, you know, he's going to be looked after for a number of years. There's no reason why the pharmacist isn't at this stage, so Sam, you know, refer on for dietetic help, just to try and help the wife feel supported and to give some more ideas to keep them on track and keep his nutrition as sound as possible, really.
Yeah, I there's a whole world out there that I just think a lot of pharmacists simply aren't exposed to, particularly if they've never worked in a kind of hospital environment, and they just don't understand the expertise that's just there, if only they would access it. Just out of interest, how long is an appointment? Imagine this gentleman, you go to see him for the first time. How long would you spend with him discussing his diet and so on?
So if I was doing a home visit with this gentleman and his wife, yeah, I'd probably be there for three quarters of an hour. Exactly. And I always look at investing time up front to fully understand, you know, their medical history, their views and attitudes towards food, what sort of role it plays in their life, how it links to their social life, how it links to their well-being. You know, have they any sort of misunderstandings around the role of food with his conditions? So yeah, you'd invest a lot of time up front, and then I'd often leave a plan in place, you know, agree the goals with the family, what did we think we can achieve. That would be documented, and I'd share that with the multidisciplinary team, and I might be working with Sam to say, oh, next time you see this gentleman, can you, you know, will you be able to weigh him? And you know, I've got colleagues now, physiotherapists I work with, who do things like hand grip strength when they're doing visits and doing physiotherapy. So, you know, we often see now much more collaborative working and shared outcomes across the team. So I'm all for working together, really. Yeah. I don't think dietitians can work in isolation. I would definitely want to encourage us all to work together and help each other and reinforce the advice for patients, knowing, you know, where your limitations lie really as a practitioner and when to refer on.
And we miss things, you know, occupational therapists looking at a patient with arthritic hands, for example. You know, you, listening to you talk then, Anne, I've made a resolution that my trainees are going to go out with a dietitian to understand actually what you can do, because at the moment I just think too many pharmacists simply aren't aware. So that's a resolution that I've made listening to Sam. How did you persuade him to go to the dietitians?
Over several consultations, I just said, you know, in the end I said, look, I don't know where to go anymore. I need to ask advice. Is it okay if I talk to, it was a friend actually, but she is a dietitian, if I talk to my friend? And it's because we had that relationship, and he thought, yeah, you know, I will talk to your friend. That's what I did in the end. Yeah. It was saying, I don't know what to do anymore.
Yeah. And that's the relationship thing. That's the kindness and the patience that we just need to try and find the time to invest in some of our older patients, rather than simply just kind of box them out into the medicines that they take. And I think, you know, that does reflect my philosophy and our philosophy, what should be our philosophy and how we manage patients such as these, I would say. And that 45 minutes, and I can absolutely see how that time invested will pay dividends, because the trust develops, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And you have to develop that rapport and take into account so many factors. But I always believe invest up front and you'll get better outcomes, rather than trying to restrict it to 20 minutes and then you find you need to go and see them four or five times. So, I'd always encourage dietitians to invest time up front if they're commissioning groups will enable them to do that. I think really get to the heart of some of the issues, and it can be quite transformative, I think. And particularly in somebody here who was a little bit resistant to the dietitian, there was perhaps some beliefs there around, you know, dietitians, oh, is this all about weight loss and, you know, sort of dieting and slimming? So I think, you know, there's something to be said about the multi-professional team, understanding each other's roles. And I think, Graham, what you highlighted there about a pharmacist spending some time with the dietitian and vice versa, and with all members of the multi-professional team, particularly in our training and undergraduate and postgraduate experience, we can learn from each other, and we should never feel that our position is being eroded by other members of the team actually reinforcing some of the advice that we're giving as dietitians. I think that makes us more effective.
Yeah, there's more work than any of us can do out there, so the more we can share the load, the better, I would say. I think, you know, it's been a wonderful listening to these case studies, actually, because it's really brought to life some of the issues, I would say, around nutrition that I think are too often overlooked in our world, the pharmacy world. And I think those things around investing time, around listening and building that rapport, and then considering the patient holistically and actually making sure that we take into account all of their needs and their well-being. So thank you, Anne and Sam, really useful insights. And I think we can take away from this how important working together is, and actually how all of us need to try our very best, particularly during the pandemic, to ensure that we do take into account all of the needs of our patients, not just their medication, but actually everything that we can help to bring together to make sure that their well-being is preserved as best we can. And I think, thank you very much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.